is, of course, the title given to the second fragment. I think that we can see that all three of these, as H.P.B. calls them, fragments, and indeed they are fragments from her description, they are translations of only some of the verses that she says belong to this work, the Book of the Golden Precepts. And I think they point up what I've called the three aspects of the spiritual path. I know this is not very readable, but I didn't want to put it in black, so you'll have to, I'll read it to you. I think that this points up the three aspects, that the first fragment, which is simply called the Voice of the Silence, in fragment one, deals with the way in which the mind can be freed from layer after layer of unreality, the movement through the three halls, the recognition of what she calls the four modes of truth, the way in which then these modes of truth, which are of course the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, and therefore the way in which the mind can be free in order that truth may be grasped by the mind. That may not be the best way of putting it, because in a sense the mind does not grasp truth, but the mind is in a condition in which truthfulness is present. Perhaps that would be a better way of saying it. That the mind is now clear. And this, I think, is what we must recognize. The mind is the great slayer of the real. It's not the mind, it's not consciousness or the mind that is established in its own nature. In just a moment, we'll come to a question that Rajapan has raised, which I think is a very important question. The second fragment, dealing with the two paths, it seems to me now the Dharma of the heart, the work of the heart, is stressed. When the mind is clear, when the mind reveals its own truthfulness, now there arises, we may say, within the heart, compassion. And so the two paths deal, therefore, this fragment, I think, deals with compassion felt by the heart, so that now we have this union. And the third that we'll be coming to and really looking at in much more on both of our next two sessions, which is called the Seven Portals, I would say is the discipline sacrifice, the life that is now one of discipline, but one in which there is sacrifice. Then the stages that embody, in other words, the spiritual virtues, which are called the Seven Portals, are dealt with. So in a sense, there is throughout this interblending of these three aspects, the mind, the heart, and the life, truth, compassion, and a life that is disciplined, but is a life that is sacrificed. Now, Rajapan has raised the question, which I think is a very good one, what do we mean by mind and what do we mean by heart? So do you want to make any comments, Rajapan?
No, I feel mind is something, you know. I mean, mind exists only when thoughts flow in.
Mm-hmm. The mind exists only when thoughts flow in?
Flow in.
Would you all...
Do you agree?
That's an interesting... How do you all...
mind is something which can accept any opinion, provided, you know.
Mm-hmm. But is there not underlying then a consciousness, a constant awareness, pure
yes,
consciousness.
I'm coming to that.
Yeah.
What is that? It is related to mind.
It's related to mind.
In what way? It's not very clear from any of these writings.
It has
been bothering me also. What is consciousness?
Yes. This is true.
It tells you this is true or this is not true.
Mm-hmm.
Which tells you accept this or don't accept this.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that ultimately tells you? That is probably consciousness.
That is probably consciousness then. So I think this is something one has to perhaps work out in a sense. Evelyn?
I think the definition of mind is too limited.
Mm.
Because if things are just coming in,
mm-hmm.
right, into an empty receptacle, they just lie to them.
Yes.
You have to have consciousness in the mind in order to do something useful or not useful, which thoughts are coming. Mm-hmm. So your consciousness is there before the thoughts come in.
Mm-hmm. All right. He would agree with that. Yes, all right. Consciousness is present. And then the conditioning then that takes place, which is thoughts, feelings, all of that. Yes.
And then what is the heart?
Then what is the heart? Wait a minute. Let Lowell answer.
According to the Mahamudra, discipline branch or path of Buddhism, they say that one has to know the nature of the mind, and the mind is, the analogy is that the mind is like an ocean or a body of water, and the thoughts are like the waves that arise on the, are not different at all from that body of water, and the thoughts arise and subside simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that nature of the mind, whether it's the moving mind, the mind that thinks, or the mind that's at rest, is to know the nature of the mind, but to know the nature of emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Some simple alternatives that could be useful, I think this grouping here, are concepts, feelings, and action. But clearly the word mind is going to be used to mean much more than that, including memories, understanding, intuitions, and all.
Yes. So it's much more than concepts, it's much more than that. And it's much more than feelings in thinking of the heart, isn't it? What were you going to say, Rajapan, about the heart?
No, I mean, we are used to saying, but this guy comes from the bottom of the heart, you know. From the depth of my heart. But what does it really mean? I think it's related to consciousness, nothing else.
It again comes back to consciousness, isn't
yes,
it, really? Because everything is consciousness,
yes.
It's rooted in consciousness.
That we forget, and never inadequate vocabulary. Words, lack of words. We use this word heart.
I think this is our problem.
Heart, here's what a bad
heart. Yeah, you see.
What you mean is something else.
This is the thing. If you look at the verses 107, 108 in the second fragment, the two paths, I think we begin to see this. To me, this verse 107 is one of the, what shall I say, most heart-rending verses in all of The Voice of the Silence.
More about the heart.
Yes. Alas, alas, that's right, heart-rending. Alas, alas, that all men should possess Alaya, be one with the great soul, and that possessing it, Alaya should so little avail them. Behold how like the moon, reflected in the tranquil waves, Alaya is reflected by the small and by the great, is mirrored in the tiniest atoms, yet fails to reach the heart of all. Alas, that so few men should profit by the gift, the priceless boon of learning truth, the right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent. Now, this whole concept, I think, of alaya is an extremely interesting concept. It's, of course, alaya simply means the non-dissolvable, that which is always there. There are many translations of alaya. It's equivalent generally to the universal soul, the oversoul in the third fundamental proposition of the sacred doctrine. I think also it refers to that fundamental basis of, or it's often called the receptacle of consciousness, the alaya vijnana, of course, in the Buddhist terminology, is consciousness, and it is the receptacle, it's the storehouse. It's been mystically identified, of course, with akasha, which is the Sanskrit term, and alaya is the northern Buddhistic term, in the sense that it's the basis or root or fountain of all beings and things, which is consciousness, which is the root consciousness, is the store consciousness, as it's often been called. I had a quote here from the Secret Oral Teachings in Tibetan Buddhist Sects by Alexandra David Neal, that it's that really store, the uninterrupted river with a continuous current, the uninterrupted river of consciousness, therefore. And therefore, it is indeed, in that sense, also the heart. According to the secret teaching, Alexandra David Neal points out, what must be understood, seen, felt, is that there does not exist any current which is my mind, and therefore it follows that there is not a plurality of currents which are the minds of other individuals, but only a single current, the sum of all mental activity at work without any cognizable beginning. It is in this totality that what we call our mind is immersed. Whether we are aware of it or not, the thoughts, the desires, the needs which we feel for life, our thirst for it, nothing of all this is completely ours, for all of it is collective. It is the flowing river of incalculable moments of consciousness having its source in the impenetrable depths of eternity. Wonderful statement, I think. As has so often been said, consciousness is a singular of which the plural is unknown. So we can put it in that way, and I think that's the way in which Schrödinger, for example, Erwin Schrödinger, has put it.
It's going to be said that it's an object of a mystical search.
Yes, but it's also the search itself.
Yeah.
And so it's where liberation comes in, because if we can liberate the mind from the problem of we become part of the selfless stream of life. We become able to realize the heartless interest because we're listening to that current.
We're listening to that current, yes. So I think this is all very useful because it helps us when we come to recognize, I think, what HPB calls the two paths, but she also, as I've used the quote, who shall first hear the doctrine of two paths in one. And of course, she says, search for the paths, and later indicates that there are two paths. Where is it? She also points out that they are, they really are one and yet two. And this, I think, leads us again to this paradox. I think that, of course, many names have been given to the two paths, and that's why I want us later to consider. I think there's a tendency to feel, well, I'm not going to go with the eye doctrine, I'm going to go with the heart doctrine, and, you know, all of this. And we abolish one path, but can we really? I think we have to begin to look at it. The distinction, of course, between them, is said in most texts, is that the Pratyeka Buddha, Eka is one, and Pratya is alone, or how would you translate it? I suppose just alone, one alone. And the Bodhisattva path, these are the way they are generally defined, although in many of the texts there are three jhanas or paths, the chakra, the Shravakas, and the Pratyeka Buddhas, and the Bodhisattvas. And Suzuki, in Outlines of Mahayana Buddhism, quotes from one of the well-known sutras, the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra. Now, the beings who have become wise have faith in the Tathagata, which is another name for the Buddha, and is translated variously. It can mean he who has thus come or he who has thus gone. So it depends on which side of the shore you're standing on, whether you see him coming or whether you see him going. Have faith in the Tathagata, the father of the world, and consequently apply themselves to his commandments. Amongst them, there are some who, wishing to follow the dictate of an authoritative voice, apply themselves to the commandment of the Tathagata to acquire the knowledge of the four great truths for the sake of their own complete nirvana. These one may say to be those who, seeking the vehicle of the Shravaka, fly from the triple world. They are the hearers. The Shravakas are the hearers. They have listened. They have simply listened. Other beings, desirous of the unconditioned knowledge of self-restraint and tranquility, apply themselves to the commandment of the Tathagata to learn to understand the 12 chains of dependence. This is the chain of interdependence that is spoken of, for the sake of their own complete nirvana. These one may say to be those who, seeking the vehicle of the Pratyeka Buddha, fly from the triple world. Other beings, again desirous of omniscience, Buddha knowledge, absolute knowledge, unconditioned knowledge, apply themselves to the commandment of the Tathagata, and learn to understand the knowledge, powers, and conviction of the Tathagata for the sake of the common weal and happiness, out of compassion to the world, for the benefit, weal, and happiness of the world at large, of both gods and men, for the sake of the complete nirvana of all beings. These, one may say, to be those who, seeking the great vehicle, fly from the triple world. Therefore, they are called Bodhisattva Mahasattvas. So here we have the characterization of the Bodhisattvas as quite distinct from the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas. On the other hand, I think there's an interesting passage, a commentary, which is given by Dr. Herbert Günther in his work, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. And it's a commentary on one of the sutras. You may now argue if it's a, he's translated a commentary. You may now argue if this nirvana is not the real one, the exalted one should not have shown these two ways. Now remember, this is clearly in Buddhistic tradition that the two ways were shown by the Buddha. So, after all, he shouldn't have shown them if one was not to have taken. Oh yes, he should have done so for the following reason. Suppose some Indian merchants go to fetch jewels from the outer sea, but in the middle of their journey, in some desert, they become exhausted and think that they cannot go on. Then, as they are about to turn back, their leader, by his miraculous power, creates a huge city for their refuge. In the same way, those of little courage take fright after hearing of the Buddha's spiritual awareness, thinking that it will be most troublesome to attain to Buddhahood, and that through their inability they will have to turn back. Then they find that they can stay where they are as Pratyeka Buddhas. So it's, I think it's an interesting suggestion that we don't have to turn back just because we think the one goal is too high. Well, first I think our attention should be perhaps given to what is meant by the path. And this subject, of course, plays and occupies an extremely important place in Buddhist thought, as it does in all religions throughout history, because there isn't a single religion that doesn't claim to have knowledge of a path, the path or a path. I am the way, the truth, and the light, said Jesus, and so on. Every tradition points to a path, the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic path, and so on. The nature of any path, of course, is generally that it begins somewhere and ends somewhere. And so it can be said that its starting point and its goal have equal significance. But as is evident from our text, the path is not something which connects two terms that are quite distinct. It's a going to, if I can put it that way, which pervades the whole of a complex manifold, which is the human being, from its foundation to its end. Our text, remember, has told us we must become the path. So it is not something external to us. The path, indeed, is said to be from samsara to nirvana, and yet at the same time we're told there's no distinction between samsara and nirvana. So we're not going anywhere. To quote Ginther again, generally speaking, the whole of reality is subsumed under the duality of samsara and nirvana. Samsara is to be understood in the sense that its ultimate nature is sunyata, its causal characteristic, bewilderment, and its primary characteristic is manifestation as misery, dukkha. The ultimate nature of nirvana is also sunyata. Its causal characteristic is the end and dispersion of all bewilderment, and its primary characteristic then is liberation from dukkha. So for the Buddhist, remember, the reality of samsara, the reality of conditioned existence, has never been doubted. It has its own reality. Samsara has its own reality. We are here. And consequently, as the great Buddhist reformer Tsongkhapa pointed out, one starts where one is. One has to start here. You can't start from any other place. You can't wait to make it. You start where you are. So both the conditioned and the unconditioned, samsara and nirvana, are sunyata. And hence, in this sense, they are the same. What has changed then, what has really changed, is the mental perception, or more properly, the attitude. And I think this is where the whole work is done, is in the attitude. The first book of the Pali Abhidharma begins with the significant words, when a healthy conscious attitude belonging to the world of sensuous relatedness, accompanied by and permeated with serenity, and associated and linked up with knowledge, has arisen. Ben.
Isn't that the definition of heart?
Yes, I think it probably is, Ellen, the definition of heart. But note it, a healthy, conscious attitude, so it's an attitude of which we're aware, conscious, a healthy, conscious attitude, belonging to the world of sensuous relatedness. So it's in our relationships in the world, it's right here, right now, accompanied by and permeated with serenity. So there is not this agitation, there's not a kind of hectic and frantic situation, and associated and linked up with knowledge. So, you know, this is where I think we have to be very careful when we say the doctrine of the I is just, you know, knowledge. Throw out knowledge. Let's get rid of all knowledge. One has to know what one is about. And this, I think, is very important. And obviously, HBB has talked of these modes of truth, which are knowledge, which is one has to know. One is not supposed to be unknowing in this effort. And in essence, I think this isn't very different from a statement that I've always loved in the Voice of the Silence, which I probably cannot find at the moment as to the exact reference of it. I thought it was in the second section. Someone else may remember it better than I do. Maybe it's... No, it's in the third fragment. It's in verse 201. Once thy foot hath pressed the bed of the nirvanic stream in this or any future life. And I think that this is that sort of coming into the essence of what we're all about. Once thy foot hath pressed the bed of the nirvanic stream, that is, once there has been even a kind of taste of what it is to be on the path, a kind of feeling, then indeed one is launched on it. So the as a Tibetan text has it, the difference between the starting point, the path, and the goal exists only on the part of him who discourses on it. In reality, there is no reason to differentiate between them, and it is permissible to say that starting point and goal are indivisible, or that path and goal are indivisible.
It's because there is an aftertaste.
Yes.
There is a need, and that's the part where the heart comes in.
I think that's true.
Because the Tibetans have this bodhicitta idea, the wish, the generation of enlightenment. It isn't that you can just automatically develop it. Sometimes you have to wish for the cultivate the need for the enlightenment of all mankind, which is what I think she means when she says, act thou for them today, and they will act for thee tomorrow. It doesn't mean you're going to be rewarded by others. It means that the renunciation for others now leads them to a state where they too will wish to give up themselves
for others. Yes, I think this is true. And I think you've brought in a very important aspect of the whole Buddhist tradition, and to me it's a very beautiful one, and that is in the Sanskrit Shraddha, which is usually translated as faith. But it's a faith of knowledge. It's not a blind faith. It's not an unknowing faith. And I think this is a very beautiful term, Shraddha. It's a very, very important word in this, a whole recognition of what is the path and the movement on the path, which is the movement of ourselves. It's not movement externally. It's a movement of ourselves, and it's a shift in attitude. It's a shift in perception. And what has to be dealt with, therefore, is our own nature, our own attitude, our own perception. And so it's been said that in some of the Mahayana Buddhist scriptures, two factors are of primary importance. The darshana marga, marga meaning path, the path of viewing, darshana of seeing or of viewing, it's a view. How do we see? How do we see others? Do we act for others because we feel sorry for them, for example, because we pity them? Or do we act for others because we think there will be a reward? remember at the very outset I mentioned there are these degrees of compassion, of karuna. Or do we act because we, can I put it this way, because we don't even see that there is another, there is only the one. So that there's a path of seeing in which one acts because one knows. And this is indeed Shraddha, dependent on Shraddha. It's dependent on that interior faith which is knowing, which is not just, as I say, it's not simply blind faith. And then the second aspect then from the path of seeing, or path of entering, it has also been called, because the sight of nirvana has been glimpsed for the first time, once thy foot hath pressed the nirvanic bed, then one must pay closest attention to that which has been seen, must never lose sight of it, no matter what happens. So the second aspect is called the bhavana marga, the path of attention, the path of seeing or the path of entering and the path of attention. And it's true we may see for a moment, but do we pay attention? Do we give attention? How often we may say in our actions, well, I didn't pay attention, and so we fell, or something happened, you know. I wasn't watching. So it's now that what is seen is not something which was absent, but there arises as a result of a change of attitude the seeing of what was there all the time. Our eyes become opened to that which was always present, but which we did not observe because we were occupied otherwise, and which we did not care to observe and to be aware of because of our own preoccupations. So since an attitude is always expressed in our behavior, the path is actually present here and now, and known in terms of our present perception and expressed through our present conduct. So in this sense, enlightenment means simply to awake from what has been called the sleep of emotional instability and to dispel the fog of intellectual argument. Well, that's from, I think it may have been Ginther, but I've rephrased it. Well, how is this accomplished? Tsongkhapa presented two methods which are really complementary and in many instances the same. The one that I like most is known as the seven causes and effects. Perfected Buddhahood, this is a translation of one of Tsongkhapa's, perfected Buddhahood arises from the thought of enlightenment. This is what Dara called the bodhicitta, very thought of it. That thought arises from altruistic aspiration. One aspires, altruistic aspiration. That aspiration from compassion, compassion from love, love from gratitude, gratitude from recollection of kindness, recollection from kindness, from seeing as mother. Now, Alex Wayman, who has written a great deal on this, explains these as follows, and I think this is a very interesting way to look at it. The candidate reflects that in the past and in all the infinite future, all the uncountable rebirths are possible through a mother's loving care. Every sentient being has sometime or other served as one's own mother. This is an interesting way of approaching it. Every sentient being has sometime or other served as one's own mother. Thus, the meditator first sees vividly his own mother, and through her passes beyond all bounds of love for all the sentient beings. He dwells on his mother's kindness in taking care of all his needs when he was completely helpless. This recollection arouses gratitude. gratitude arouses love. Having gotten into that frame of mind, he recognizes as his mother also his father and friends. He then proceeds to the more advanced task of recognizing as his mother the neutral persons. When he is able to regard the latter the same way as he thinks of his friends, he proceeds to the still more advanced task of recognizing as his mother all his enemies. No man is my friend, no man is my enemy. All alike are my teachers, all alike are my mothers. When the latter can be seen this way, he recognizes all the living beings of the 10 directions as his mother, expanding his meditation into the boundless state. In this way, he brings on the boundless state of love. Having come to see all these sentient beings as one's mother in the boundless state of love, the meditator then reflects on their manifold sufferings in their subjection to reincarnation. The intense realization of suffering by empathy with the loved objects, the mother, produces compassion. As applied to all the sentient beings, one enters the boundless state of compassion. Having this compassion through realizing the sufferings of these sentient beings, the meditator then aspires to free them from suffering and to bring them happiness, as one wishes to do this for one's mother. Hence the next stage, called altruistic aspiration, which expands into the third boundless state of sympathetic joy, with all the happiness accruing to those sentient beings. The next stage is reflection on the thought of enlightenment itself as having the two aims of enlightenment for oneself and the deliverance for others. Quite a meditation, you can see. Quite a meditation. If one were to practice that kind of meditation and move step by step, it would be an amazing progression, isn't it? But beginning then, with one's own mother, with gratitude, the recollection of kindness, which brings gratitude, from gratitude, love, from love, compassion, from compassion, aspiration, from altruistic aspiration, the thought of enlightenment.
You're quoting from the Lamrim?
So this is, yes, this is the Lamrim, yes, and Alex Wayman's commentary. Mm-hmm. So, we can then, I think, begin to recognize these two ways as perhaps so interlinked, you see, that that while the Prajika Buddha concentrates his energies on the one objective of spiritual awakening, he raises himself to the spiritual realm of his own inner being and is there, in that sense, achieves it for himself instead of listening to this call, as HBB calls it, the call of compassion to return and help. He's been compared, the Prajika Buddha has been compared to the mystic, statement of Plotinus, the flight of the alone to the alone. So that, in that sense, the mystic who does not return. There are some 30 different ways in which the Prajika Buddha can be characterized. I've only put down three, and I said fill in other characteristics. As you read the voice, for example, the rugged path of fourfold dhyana, which is a rugged path indeed of concentration. Prajika Buddha, as compared to the steeper path of the Paramita heights. There are many different ways in which these have been characterized. The first path, the second path, the Dharma of the eye, the Dharma of the heart, head learning, heart wisdom, exoteric, esoteric, the open path, the secret path, and so on. I won't go through them all. But I think that because the ideal that is presented to us in the Voice of the Silence is very clearly the Bodhisattva path, then I think we perhaps need to consider it very carefully. What is the Bodhisattva path? The term Bodhisattva means a number of different things and refers to various levels of spiritual attainment. Sat is Venus, Tva is the ness, it's the essence of one's being, is Bodhi. And Bodhi is to be awake from Buddha. The essence of one's being is compassion, wisdom, but simply the essence of one's being is awake. One is at all times awake in the path of attention, therefore. So we have then this Bodhisattva ideal, and there are various forms in which the Bodhisattva pledge is given. It's said that Kuan Yin is said to have taken this pledge. One form of it is, never will I seek nor receive private individual salvation. Never will I enter into final peace alone, but forever and everywhere will I live and strive for the redemption of every creature throughout the world from the bond, throughout the world from the bonds of conditioned existence. Now at the same time, it is said that the Bodhisattva knows that, of course, there is no one to be led to liberation. There is no one who is outside of this. It's said, therefore, but although innumerable beings have been thus led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. And why? If in a bodhisattva the perception of a being should take place, he would not be called a Buddha being, Bodhi being. He is not to be called a Bodhi being in whom the perception of a self should take place, or the perception of a being, or the perception of a living soul, or the perception of a person. So while he says this, as it were, now this is said to be the pledge, he also recognizes, never will I seek nor receive private individual salvation. There is no I, there is no one to be led to nirvana, because there is only the one. So the thing that I think is revealed about this is that the pledge, in a sense, the Bodhisattva vow, can only be authentically taken by one who cannot use speech as we normally use it, or make any claims, because there are no claims to be made. So how can he claim to lead all to nirvana, when there is no claim is to be made? A vow is usually taken to someone or something, but in this case, the Bodhisattva cannot take this vow to human beings, because he works for them whether or not they realize, understand, or even care. And at the same time, he knows that there is no one outside himself. So one can say, just what is it that the Bodhisattva wishes to do for all beings? While it is clear that he cannot save another, we might perhaps give one defining characteristic of the Bodhisattva as constant attention to the true self-interest of others. That his own self-interest is the self-interest of others. And so he must therefore have the wisdom to know what is the self-interest of others. And coming back to the concept of the mother, you say, does the mother always do everything for the child? What is the child's self-interest? Does the mother let the child fall when he attempts to walk? Does the mother On the other hand, let the child play with matches, and so on. So one has to begin to look at this very, very carefully. Well, we come to the questions that I'd like to say a little bit more about the Bodhisattva path, because that obviously is the one to which HPB is referring throughout. In Suzuki's commentary on one of the sutras, we find some very interesting remarks about what assists one in becoming a bodhisattva, and presuming that that may be our desire, our goal, our intent at some point. One element that is taken as most important, because I think we, as I say, the path begins here. It begins where we are. It begins now. It doesn't begin somewhere else in some future life. And as we were discussing, Mary Jo and I, during the break, I think a very useful meditation is the one in which one begins to perceive that every being in the universe is one's mother. Not, you know, it's very easy to feel love towards one's own mother, gratitude, and so on, and building up in these stages, but to see everything in that sense that it's a nurturing. Everything nurtures the Buddha nature within us, and that is the mother. Everything nurtures the Buddha nature. Now, therefore, one element that is taken as very important in the sutras is the cultivation of good friends, what is known as Kalyana Mitra, good friends. And Suzuki then asks the question, what constitutes a good friend? Well, are they those who are our friends because they can use us and exploit us for their own purposes? Or who are friends because of a kind of neurotic dependence? And who attach themselves to us because they lack a kind, they lack something in themselves, and so on. And there is a kind of friendship that one can call a kind of mutual vampirization of each other, of one another. But the good friend, of course, cannot be the exploiter, nor solely moved by needs, must be one who can benefit and uplift the other. It's been suggested that the good friend leaves each one he meets with a little clearer intimation, a little stronger feeling of the germ of Buddhahood within himself, and of the possibility, therefore, of becoming more than himself. Perhaps it's this reason why it's been said that when two or more good friends work together, there's a powerful current in generating the highest. Perhaps this is the meaning of the Christian assertion, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. And there are interesting words of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita in the 9th chapter. Unto thee who findeth no fault, I will now make known this most mysterious knowledge. So one can see, first of all, what is required, what can we do right here and now to become good friends to each other. And one can also ask the question, what kind of view of the universe would the Bodhisattva have? What kind of view does he have? It must be, of course, a profound realization of the essential unity of all things, a unity that's reflected on every plane of existence. So that then, how would the Bodhisattva view karma? Not as an obstacle or a burden, but as perhaps a fact in that must be dealt with at all points. He must then recognize differentiation, but not make it a distinction, if I can put it that way. On the other hand, I think there is ample evidence in the sutras, and certainly, as I pointed out in the first fragment of HPB, that there has also to be a concern with that which one knows, the doctrine of the eye, if you like, the knowledge. So that's why I suggest, what is the value of each path? Is the Prajika Buddha simply to be, does he play a role? Can he be Buddha, which means to come to a certain state of enlightenment? Is there no role whatsoever? Is there value in what we may call a balancing of the two paths, which are the two paths in one? Do you begin to see, is there any value? The flight of what Plotinus calls the flight of the alone to the alone.
In your story, which you gave about the city appearing to the sea, what that says to me is that even in those very high path, to be very long in the path, means that the clinging and samsara can be very, very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one has to recognize that even in people that are highly evolved, they still have, not to be made by them, still have clinging.
Mm-hmm.
We all have, mm-hmm. We all cling to something.
We all cling to something. I see them that way, but that's why I want to see what you feel it may be the value in each of them. And you know, thinking of the good friend, coming back to that story which I related, that Ginther relates, you see, let me read it again and think about it now. Suppose some Indian merchants go to fetch jewels from the outer sea, but in the middle of their journey, in some desert, they become exhausted and think that they cannot go on. Then, as they are about to turn back, their leader, by his miraculous power, creates a huge city for their refuge. In the same way, those of little courage take fright after hearing of the Buddha's spiritual awareness, thinking that it will be most troublesome to attain to Buddhahood, and that through their inability they will have to turn back. Then they find that they can stay where they are as Pratyeka Buddhas. Now, thinking of that in terms of the good friend, as well as what Lowell has said just now, if we were to say to someone, you see, well, obviously you're never going to make Buddhahood in this life, you know, quite obviously you're not going to, but I'll make something as just as comfortable for you. Are we performing an act of a good friend?
Wouldn't it be being intensely aware of the potentiality there?
Yes.
But you're still alleviating suffering.
So, yes. You see, they find they can stay where they are as Pratyeka Buddhas. And they have created this city, which is a safe refuge, a haven, for other travelers going across the desert, which is a service, in a sense, and yet is not perhaps the final goal, the ultimate, but serves as a way station.
One thing I noticed just this morning that I hadn't realized before between the two paths is that one is brings into the element of gratitude, and the other one doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of something I can repeat about people that are so, the ones that believe in karma and that type of thing, they think they have no gratitude. They think, well, it's my karma, you know, either from this life or for a former life. So it seems that element in their life is not very important for strong. They're realizing, the gratitude is an important constituent in your psychic makeup.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is, very important. Interesting.
Perhaps one thing might help. The Dalai Lama often explains the difference between the Pratekya and the Sharaka paths and Bodhisattva. Simply, we all want to have happiness, true happiness, and avoid suffering. Mm-hmm. And he says the lower stages, if you look at this as stages, mm-hmm. is to avoid harm. So you could say that the Pratekya Buddha path does fine. It avoids causing suffering, mm-hmm. Which is okay. Mm-hmm. But the Bodhisattva must be that plus, bestow help, mm-hmm. give lessons. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could think of it that way. They have done the best they could to avoid harm. Mm-hmm. They sit up and mm-hmm. cry or live in harm for a long time.
Yes. So at least.
Because the silence is for the healer.
Yes, it's for.
She had to stir that high and noble ideal. Mm-hmm. If she were to follow the master's wish for the resurgence of the theosophical movement to accomplish, to alleviate the suffering of humanity, mm-hmm. this ideal had to be put up there at the foremost.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. But this is not to say that the other path does not have, that it may not be intertwined. Because certainly knowledge, she stresses that, as I've said, to know, to come to know.
But when she says the Dharmakaya rule, it cuts off your awareness of mm-hmm.
yes.
part. Mm-hmm. I don't know what part of this, but I take the path along mm-hmm. the way to think, but once entering mm-hmm. into the Nirvana Kim, mm-hmm. that want
yeah.
to hear anymore
of
the
suffering.
Yes.
And
that's, I think,
searches.
Yes.
Well, remember, this work is designed for people who want to at least try.
To at least try,
so she
yes.
has a point in a rather paint in a darker light. Mm-hmm. We partake of that.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. it exists. So it's
it exists. And therefore, it's part. Perhaps I can ask it this way. Mm-hmm. Could there be any achievement of Buddhahood, and after all, the Pratyeka Buddha is known as a Buddha of certain stature, awakeness. Could there be any achievement at any point along the way that is outside the economy of nature and therefore value in the entire system?
Grace.
Grace? Mm-hmm. Mary Jo, you?
Sorry. This isn't really related to your current question, but I was thinking in terms of evolution. Is it possible that ultimately the Pratekya Buddha will develop in some way through the grace of the Bodhisattva the desire to further their evolution?
Yes.
Well, that happens to be exactly mm-hmm. the esoteric Buddhist teaching that mm-hmm. at some point they're approached. Mm-hmm. The Bodhisattvas, as they sit in their high state of samadhi and nirvana, they're approached and say, do you really think you want to spend the rest of your
yes.
things to do and
wake up
mm-hmm. try this path?
Yes. Well, coming back to this little story, you see, here they are in this city, which has a great reality for them. But supposing someone, you know, like Plato's cave, someone gets up from the city and says, oh, look, there's more out there. There's something we must do beyond the city limits. That the city we're abiding in is really just an illusion. It doesn't really exist. We've got to move. We've got to take another path. I think this can come about, yes.
Can it come about before the clauses of the Kalayan, before the next mantra? Can it come about in this once they've accepted nirvana?
Good.
I would just guess they're probably stages of protection.
Yes, I would think so. I think
they're,
yes.
Sort of
that's right. I think it can. But is there not, you see, let us look at it from yet another point of view. In the Christian tradition, we have the Trappist monks who maintain silence and who may be said then to be almost equivalent to the Prajñāka Buddha in a certain, there's a certain analogy, not equivalent, but a certain analogy may obtain there. Do they not perform, even so, a service, although it is not the service, let us say, of the Franciscan order? Is there a service that, are there various kinds of service?
They evoke an energy.
They evoke an energy, uh-huh. That's true.
Yes.
And that has its influence. What I'm getting at is that while HPB is very clear and paints the Prajñāka Buddha path as not the path for the few, and it's very true, this is dedicated to the few, I think we can't feel that it's all together outside the whole range of the evolutionary pattern.
Well, again, ordinary Buddhism gives explanations of their value,
mm-hmm.
and saying, for example, that they don't teach verbally mm-hmm. very well, but by example,
mm-hmm.
they don't usually make disciples, but by mm-hmm. example, but also that they're kind of concentrating on one particular area, which is the chain of cause and effect, karma mm-hmm. and the dharma.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests that they have some special competence in perhaps adjusting whatever they can or mm-hmm. tinkering around the chain of cause and effect.
Yes.
But they're not teachers.
Mm-hmm. That's why I asked the second one that we consider. Is it possible to be a bodhisattva without knowing, without being aware of the Prajñāka Buddha path? If the bodhisattva is all compassion, is it possible to be a bodhisattva without the experience of this aloneness?
Why not?
I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it is. So I'm asking. Maybe it is.
Do you objectively pick a path, or sometimes be the subject of it, just find yourself on a path? Maybe that is
maybe that's it. How do we know the path? How do we know ourselves?
You're asking in some way, how does this compassion develop?
Mm-hmm.
How does this tremendous feeling
mm-hmm. yes.
for others?
Mm-hmm. Might there not be an entire life, for example, given over to perhaps moving within
larger sense, there is the knowing mm-hmm. of the two.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But perhaps in one phase or in one lifetime, if you will, mm-hmm. but thinking in the overall.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. So
the
that, yes, so that the division becomes artificial.
Yes, I too feel almost exactly that, which is that they're complementary, and mm-hmm. perhaps as one goes from life to life, they're just cycling between the two
mm-hmm.
poles until they're balanced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you need to now lens before you can have compassion with the other, or learn the beings and feel around as humans. On the other hand, I think that maybe the Bodhisattva is a more balanced, as presented there, it's the more balanced and more whole state.
But it would have to include then, from that point of view, if it's to be the more whole, it would have to include the experience of the Prajñāka Buddha.
Yes, that's right. I think you have to know what you're giving up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you really have to be face to face with the opportunity to say yes or no. I mean, you have to see how good, much good you're giving up to do for others. Mm-hmm. There's an illustration that shows the monkey, the man, and the elephant walking up the path, and showing that the monkey's leading the way to the cultured mind, and it just shows the progression, and then it shows at the very, very end of the path where the man on the elephant without the monkey is going into nirvana, and then it shows where he turns the elephant around and starts the path back down again. Huh. So from that I would guess that one really has to see the box of chocolates before you can truly pass on it.
Yes. Yes, that was another question I wanted to ask. You see, if we say that, as she says, that renunciation is the, and perhaps therefore we take off this line, so that we can, as it were, we see that it's a movement in that sort of direction. Can there be any renunciation? And she talks about renunciation without really knowing what we're renouncing. And I think the box of chocolates is very good. If you've never tasted a chocolate, it's very easy to say, no, I won't have any.
Well, I think, I would express it this way, but I don't know whether it seems relevant, is that the more you discipline yourself, the happier you are, or not. Mm-hmm. The happier you are may have a different meaning to different people, but it's almost as if, well, if you discipline yourself, you see at least a clearer direction. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you're contented with that, maybe that direction, maybe small, but at least by disciplining yourself, you see that you've made some progress forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Is it necessary, in other words, that we be unhappy, that we deprive ourselves of everything, in order to follow what we think of as the Bodhisattva ideal?
I think if you make it through the conscious awareness of giving up, then doesn't the whole issue become a contrivance?
Tibetans spend a great deal of time in this game, mm-hmm. because the fact is, I don't think it is necessary to literally stand and wait for your vanguard to fall on your head in order to learn something. We talked about it in the class. So they do, but they do say it's important. You must, that's why they're meditating for years on, say, the first noble truth, the nature of this samsara, this ordinary suffering. Because they say that you have to be really convinced. You can't help other people if you don't really believe it's so bad. And I think we all, you know, we all want to go out and bless the world, but I think it's basically because we want to have more happiness. We're not really that terribly upset in this world yet. Otherwise, we'd be a lot more earnest in the way we live. So the Tibetans have this stages of the practice, and they emphasize all the so-called lower things. Mastering the notion of karma, suffering is real. Before they even get into this, and that's why sacrifice and reform is so important, we make it essential that people really understand and feel in their heart these so-called lower things that a lot of people used to just give over the back of their hand and then jump right into the noble bodhisattva stuff, but they weren't really bodhisattva.
I think the
integrity and renunciation is very important, because if it's a sort of forced thing, if we can't make ourselves give up everything, mm-hmm. that's highly unnatural. But I think there's a natural time when we want to let go, and that is the natural renunciation.
Yes. Yes, is it there? Yes, I think this is the thing. Is there a forced renunciation for appearances, or is there, do we follow an interior integrity? Is there a natural time for? Yes, Virginia?
The key there is the word embedded. Because discipline and sacrifice are specifics, and this is a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But it's embedded.
Mm-hmm.
So it is,
mm-hmm.
therefore, non-specific.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if we keep thinking in terms of the specifics, or the thou shalt nots, or whatever,
yes.
then you aren't getting into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when you are embedded,
it isn't. It really is, yes. Yes, you see, because at the conclusion in the third fragment, of course, she points out, by this time, compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws. Eternal harmony alias self. A shoreless universal essence, the light of everlasting right and fitness of all things. The law of love eternal. The more thou dost become at one with it, thy being melted in its being, the more thy soul unites with that which is, the more thou wilt become compassion absolute. So it's not, I will be compassionate, but one is revealing one's own nature, one's own very essence, one's revealing one's self at every stage, which is an interesting thought. So, in that, is it not necessary to pursue, then, as it were, this constant probing, which is the integrity of one's being?
So the words you mentioned in the beginning, attention,
mm-hmm.
and the word you just mentioned, then comes understanding.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it is the path of seeing and the path of paying attention to that which one has seen. And then compassion, because compassion then is not something one assumes, but one releases, one is.
I misread the words. Embedded, it's embodied.
Embodied.
No, this is the same thing.
Well, it's all right, embodied in the life. It's embedded, embodied in the life. It's all right, it's all right. We can have it embedded too, it's embedded in us.
Maybe a keynote for this whole path business, so they're 169 and 70. The way to find the freedom is within myself, with all capital letters, higher self. That way begins and ends outside of self, small self.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we were to mull that over for many a year, mm-hmm. it would clarify things quite a bit.
Yes, it is. Yes, I think those are the real keynote. The way to final freedom is within thyself, the universal self, the one self. But that way begins and ends outside of the personal self.
So I suspect a lot of what we think is the path is really just leading to the path.
It really, yes, it's really the probationary path. It's the way to it. But it's the discovery of ourselves as the path. If we have to become the path, then it's the discovery of ourselves, isn't it?
In cultivating the wish for enlightenment, that the teacher, the Dalai Lama speaks of, it's a joyous experience when you cultivate it with the whole in mind. It's mm-hmm. not sad to mm-hmm. cultivate that kind of wish for mm-hmm. enlightenment at mm-hmm. all.
He made a joke of it, as a matter of fact. When people talk about giving up everything and slaving for humanity, he said it's kind of odd, because there is no suffering, really.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, if it's genuine, of course,
mm-hmm.
there's no suffering, there's only suffering.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I say. Even the Bodhisattva vow recognizes that there are no beings to be led, because there's no suffering, essentially, because it's in our attitude. It's in
the Bodhisattva himself.
Yes.
no stray.
It's no stray. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We look on and we may say that the Bodhisattva, his suffering is in his very limitation because of assuming a vehicle within the manifested system.
One final thing for me, in 2001, HPV mentioned in the volume 12, I guess it's also in the fifth volume of the Old Secret Doctrine, that they're using the principles of man, each of the four eternal ones has an aspect, and one eternal one is Buddhi, mm-hmm. which I think corresponds to this Elias, that produces an aspect, a lower principle, Kama Manas.
Kama Manas, yeah.
So I suspect those are the protective mm-hmm. and the Bodhisattva duality, mm-hmm. those two principles. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think you're right on that, Nicholas, that the correspondence is there. And so it is a matter of attitude, it's a matter of perception, it's a matter of seeing.
It also suggests that at some point, since Kama Manas is an aspect, that you protect the Buddha, get out of it.
Get out of it, that's the thing, that's what I mean. So that's why it seems to me that it's a stage on the way and cannot be overlooked. And nor can it be. It must be recognized that there are times when we go within, and we must go within. And to know loneliness, really, to know that both the pain and the ecstasy of it, because there can be an ecstasy of aloneness, and there can be the pain of loneliness. I think there's a difference between loneliness and aloneness, isn't there?
I've always been, maybe I'm a hybrid, but I tried, you know, like fasting for 5 days, and it's, you know, I was wondering whether God was to say to us, do we eat one meal a day or one meal every other day? But who set up all these laws that, you know, said you had to eat exactly 3 meals a day? Or, and when I started to do that, it gave you a funny feeling that you were like giving up a friend, but you experienced a... you had to look at yourself rationally and say, well, now, I decided to eat. Well, after 5 days, I looked at the world a little bit differently, as if I was not depending so much on the idea of eating food, or that I had done. It seemed like I was looking at the world in a lot of different ways when I finally decided to go back to eating. It gave you a different feeling that you're going, looking at the world entirely different. What did you really depend on when you were depending on your body for mm-hmm. some sort of substance? And you can, I think, go longer than I did, but I understand that it's recommended that you do this. When you go back to eating it, you go back to what they call a gradual eating of like little segments of baby food. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a funny feeling that you had to control your form to do this gradually. And it was an odd sensation, I think, that we think we have to have food at a certain time. It isn't really true.
Felix?
I don't know if this really connects with what you've been saying, because I haven't been here long enough. But I remember I have heard a number of idealists saying, I want to renounce my life, my period in Devacham, and the bliss of between lives, in order to serve humanity, so I'll come back and be reincarnated at once in order to serve. And I heard a person who I thought was very wise once when he heard that, and he said, I don't think anybody will be allowed to make the choice to come back immediately until they have had a taste of Devacham and they know what they're renouncing. Mm-hmm. And if they can still do it, then fine.
Yes. It does. It does. Yes, it applies to us very much, and it does apply. I think that, you see, this is why it is very easy to rush into the Bodhisattva vow and to do it from the point of view, I will do this because I want to. And I think this is the also part of it. Is there a subtle sort of thing that I remember many years ago when I was on the staff at our national headquarters, and a group of us, this was many years ago, a group of us decided that we ought, each one of us would do one kind act or good deed or something like that each day, but never tell anybody about it, you see, never say what it was. Well, it became really sort of hilarious because, you know, we'd go around and sort of feel smug, I've done my good deed, you see, and then you'd sort of needle someone and say, you done yours yet, you see, just to be sure we were all on our toes. Well, we finally, yes, and we started watching, we started a group of, it was when the staff was really quite comparatively small from what it is now, and all in one building before we had the publishing house building, so we could watch each other a little more closely. But it really became sort of hilarious, and after a few weeks we gave it up because it was just this sort of, well, I've done mine, now have you done yours, and sort of thing. So I think one has to, again, it comes back to personal integrity. It comes back to really the probing and looking within, and I think the voice of the silence, reading this can help us, certainly, and it awakens within us, I think, this overwhelming feeling of something we want to be, something we want to discover within ourselves that we are already, because the Buddha nature is there. And it's the discovery of it, it's the unearthing of it, and then the acting and living in accordance with it. Well, our time is moving on. Wednesday, as I say, I want to move, in a sense, to what should be the final one, but because I want to indicate what she says with regard to what are known as the doctrine of the Trikaya, three vestures, which even now we can begin to understand in some way, I think. And then the portals, the seven gateways, she uses different terms that are particularly emphasized in the third fragment, the Paramita Heights on Friday, because I just like to leave it at that point rather than switching it around. But so I'll see you again on Wednesday, and we'll carry on. Thank you.